We often have movie tropes where the media acts on its own, utilizing the material around us to make us think that something paranormal is going on. It sets off a primal fear in us, because television, music, and gaming are all safe zones where we can relax and where we're vulnerable. So when a game in the modern day promises it will learn from you and judge your choices, we usually side-eye it since there's an arbitrary set of rules the mechanics must follow, resulting in a generally unsatisfying outcome. However, there have been games that did that successfully on a multitude of levels. Amnesia: The Dark Descent did it masterfully with the concept of sanity. Alien Isolation adapts the Xenomorph's AI to you, and it learns your habits for greater immersion. But one game actually takes it to the meta level, and did so over 20 years ago. That game is today's focus, and is widely regarded as one of the greatest psychological horror games of all time. Eternal Darkness. Let's start right at the beginning with some of the more factual content, before we strip apart the skin and dive into the guts. The first and only installment in its series, Sanity's Requiem, was developed by Silicon Knights and published as Nintendo's first M-rated game on June 24th, 2002. It was also the first release since Satoru Iwata became Nintendo's president. Though it was originally planned for the Nintendo 64, it was ultimately released on GameCube. Unfortunately, the sales were pretty low. At another time, it may have received the attention it deserved, but a new title simply couldn't compete with the Resident Evil remake that was released only a few months prior. Of course, Super Mario Sunshine and Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker were also released that year, along with a new Grand Theft Auto. One really can't be surprised Eternal Darkness didn't take off in a bigger way. During this time, the gaming market as a whole was bringing out classic after classic. Eternal Darkness was destined to be a cult hit. But, as we know with cult hits, they have a way of growing over time, and the appreciation never ceased for Eternal Darkness's abilities to play with the player. Resident Evil will, of course, always be among the most iconic horror titles in gaming, regarded as one of the great innovators of third-person horror. So it's no surprise the competition might take it into consideration when designing their next release. But while there are obvious parallels between Eternal Darkness and Resident Evil, Eternal Darkness absolutely possesses enough unique features to stand apart. Today, our games have long, detailed storylines. There's enough cutscenes put in, for better or worse, to make a movie. That's what we've come to expect as the norm. But it hasn't always been this way, especially for horror. Resident Evil, in its inception, contained very little backstory, and what cutscenes it did contain were short, suggestive clips with no dialogue. Which, given how the early voice acting sounded, was probably for the best. It left most of the story up for interpretation by the player. And don't get me wrong, some people just want to be told what's up so they can start shooting zombies. But some of us prefer context to the situation. A backdrop to why our hapless protagonist is stuck in this doomed mansion and what corners we should be weary of as we explore it. In comparison, the sanity effect may be the most unique feature to Eternal Darkness, and alongside 1995's Clock Tower, The First Fear, and 2001 cult hit Ill Bleed, it was one of the first industry-level games to utilize the concept. We'll discuss it in detail shortly, but when it comes to submerging yourself into a character's madness, nothing does it better. And it could be argued that the concept was perfected within Eternal Darkness. The developers found a way to integrate the user's experience with real life in a way that just hadn't been done in 2002. There's no denying that a heavy dose of Lovecraft, Poe, and other well-known authors were inspirations in the conceptualizing of this cosmic horror showcase. But it's also a unique world unto itself. For the casual horror fan, jump scares can usually get the job done. But for the hardcore horror fan, there's a strong desire for the lingering fear. The one that keeps you up long after you're done playing. Psychological horror sticks in the audience's mind long after the credits roll on a film, because it's often posing a provocative question that the audience member fixates on, thus compounding the effect. This can be used in all subgenres of horror, from slasher films awakening us to the harsh reality of a psychopath living nearby, to sci-fi horror, like The Thing, highlighting the very real fear of disease spreading with reckless abandon. That's not to say jump scares both in gaming or movies aren't effective, but in all of horror, the true fear is in the knowledge they can come to you if you're not diligent. Games like Amnesia: The Dark Descent play on the player's innate fear of the unknown, arguably one of the most effective ways to scare anybody. What are the noises coming from just down the hall? What is that in the water? You don't know, but the thought terrifies you. Jaws does it. Subnautica does it. Eternal Darkness does it. But this game isn't always about what's on the surface. Sometimes, if you want to dig deeper, you have to take a leap of faith. Now that you understand a bit about the background of the game, let's dive into the darkness itself. Chapter 1, A Death in the Family. Eternal Darkness is a revolving door in time, carefully designed to bring all the greatest aspects of horror together in one neatly wrapped and damn near perfect package of terror. Even its name was chosen to encompass that which we all, consciously or subconsciously, fear most. The eternal darkness. Think about that. We have a primal fear of the dark, of the unknown, from birth, and it never truly fades. We learn to live with it, but from the earliest days of our ancestors, we, as a species, have strived to defeat it, to push it far away with fire and our ever-evolving command of electricity. But it's always there. The game begins with an introduction from the narrator, Edward Roivas. He starts by explaining he's already dead. But the story he came to tell isn't about him, or even his family. It's about humanity. And it all started with a wretched book bound together in flesh and bone by the strangest magical incantation. He says our perceptions cannot change reality. It can only color it. It says humanity has been on the edge of extinction for 2 millennia. Ignorant too much and dependent on few. Then, we're told, the guardians grow restless. Their time once again nears. In the past, whether by fate or misfortune, the Roivas family crossed paths with the guardians. Edward may be dead as our story begins, lamenting the family tragedy from the great beyond. But his granddaughter, Alex, is very much alive, and it is on her that the guardians have set their sights. Of course, she doesn't know that yet. This is where you, the player, come in as Alex's nightmare doubles as your quick monster-killing tutorial. Once complete, she's woken by the loud ringing of a telephone. Inspector LaGrasse with the Rhode Island Police is calling to inform her of an accident with her grandfather. That's all he needs to say, and Alex agrees to be on the next flight. She later meets the inspector at the crime scene, and their conversation is terrible, but in an almost retro-artistic way that you can't help but appreciate, especially since the rest of the story is so well done. But, basically, the inspector is stumped. The victim's head is missing, and no clues were left. But Alex is sure there must be some kind of clues the police overlooked. Vowing to uncover the truth, she decides to search the mansion herself. Edward conducted all his research there. If there was ever any hope of finding a connection to his past, and possibly his murderer, it would be there. Almost immediately upon being left alone, we see a message. The last weak rays of sunlight fight the shroud of darkness. It lends an eerie feel to the last few weeks' events. As the sun sets, Alex will be alone in this house, with nothing but the spirits of old for company. The first level takes horror fans to a cozy, familiar setting, with the classic night in a haunted house. But as you interact with the various items to solve the cryptic clues, it soon evolves into so much more. Finally, in Edward's private study, there's a large, leather-bound antique book atop his cluttered desk. When Alex picks it up, she's struck by visions of hideous monsters, and she reads of a Roman military commander named Poius Augustus, the first of the other protagonists. The player is launched into ancient Roman times to see Pius's experience firsthand. The addition of the extra playable protagonist essentially creates a second game within the first, where Alex maintains the more Resident Evil style. The trips to the past offer the player multiple scenarios full of action, adventure, and horror. To add yet another touch of authenticity and to separate this game from the pack at the time, we're made to read subtitles for the first part of the Romans' dialogue as characters speak Latin. A battle has just ended, and Pius orders his soldiers to be well-rested, alluding to many more still ahead as they continue their search for the artifact. Once alone, a mysterious voice lures Pius to a circle of tall, monolithic stones with runes etched into the surface. When he stands in the center, the stone activates and transports him to a hidden, underground temple where he discovers three artifacts. One red, one blue, and one green. You need to choose one, but despite your decision, it all ends with Pius being enslaved by a cosmic, godlike being known as an Ancient. Each artifact represents a different entity, and the storyline features minor, yet significant changes, depending on which you pick. An important detail for later. Above all, you'll need a working knowledge of how the Ancient's attributes affect one another, and overall gameplay. It's like rock, paper, scissors, but with undead gods. Each has a strength and weakness to the other, forming a perfectly balanced system that will be vital to formulating your strategy. The relic you choose will alter not only which enemies you face, but which spells you'll need to defeat them. Green insanity is weak against red power, but strong against magic, which I think is poetic, because it's essentially saying that no matter what kind of otherworldly powers you may possess, the unparalleled power of insanity trumps all. This, of course, means power is weak against magic, which is equally suiting. Zulathoth, the goddess of insanity, has a dark green emerald artifact shaped like a warped angel, and her madness is a brilliant telling of the horrors one could face if left to argue with their inner demons for eternity. She has two voices, forever at odds with one another, yet clearly pieces of a greater whole. The first voice is similar to a wicked queen from a dark fairy tale, loud and ominous, while the second is soft, but no less sinister. It's the kind of creepy that sends cold chills down your neck and arms, like a ghost has whispered in your ear, and the cold breath still lingers. She's often considered the strangest of the ancients, but can you really blame her? They spend eternity planning and plotting these extremely specific events, knowing full well one misstep along the way is essentially pressing reset. And all the while, other ancients are trying to get there first. Not only does Zelototh have to guard herself against sabotage while actively manipulating humanity and the other ancients, she must constantly battle herself as well. Truthfully, it was likely the hardest one. There's no break, no relief from the voices in our heads. You can't run away. You can't lie. You can't hide. It's every coward's worst nightmare. Luckily, Zelototh is also the smartest of the main three ancients, which is how she managed to stay in the game as long as she has. Her sadistic nature especially shines in the way her zombies are created. Corpses are forced into servitude by a cacophony of voices, torturing them into existence. Still, nothing encapsulates true insanity quite like her grand plan. If successful, she would kill all life on Earth, so her minions and a few revived humans could kill each other until the end of time. You see, it's one thing to have me-against-the-world fantasies where you dream of taking sweet revenge on those who made you a punching bag. But it's another to possess the ability and desire to end all life everywhere. Except for what sounds like a never-ending series of Bloodsport contests. Nightmare Edition. A unique, if violent, plan. Ulioth, the god of magic, is represented by a pale blue dome statue. It's hard not to compare his appearance to that of a jellyfish, but these are Lovecraft-based, and that man did love his sea creatures. Ulioth's powers include not only magic, but also the ability to manipulate the dimensional planes. Even his artifact is known to fade between realities, never fully existing, or not existing. A somewhat Schrodinger's cat situation, wherein two opposing scenarios are simultaneously true, despite the literal impossibility of coexistence. Finally, Chaturga, represented by a red-clawed worm, is the god of matter, and his powers revolve around physical strength and endurance. His aggressive personality suits his character well, a recognizable character trope. He relies heavily on raw power and resilience, as do his skinless minions. Despite their very different approaches, all three entities share the same goal, if for different reasons. They want an unsuspecting mortal to summon them to Earth, so they might better rejoice in the nourishment of human bodies and souls. Unfortunately for Alex, there are pages missing from the sinister book, so she must continue searching through the mansion in hopes of learning more and understanding what she's just experienced. Chapter 2, The Madness. The second chapter begins when Alex notices a page of the tome framed on the wall of Edward's study. This time, the player is taken to Cambodia in the year 1150, more than 1,000 years after Pius was enslaved. This time, you take on the role of Elia, a young girl who was taken the Tome of Eternal Darkness and ran away from home. Like any child who reads an adventure book, Elia wanted to live the tales for herself. Since you no longer have the body of a warrior, you can't fight like one either. Instead, you must solve more complex puzzles in order to advance through the level, switching up the gameplay once again. This is also where the sanity meter effect comes into play. And you must remember to keep an eye on your sanity meter. Should it break, your character will break along with it. Aside from how almost poetically perfect this feature serves as a metaphor, one can't help but appreciate the extra incentive to actually fight your way through levels. In so many others, the player is able to simply run straight through the entire section without facing conflict. But now, one must stand to fight in order to survive with their sanity intact. Because when the true effects of insanity begin creeping in, they creep in big. At first, the changes are minor. They're subtle, little things. Aesthetics typical of horror game backgrounds. Blood pouring down the walls, statues turning your way. But this is nothing compared to what happens when the meter begins to deplete in earnest. Sometimes you may turn into a zombie, or your head might suddenly fall off. For a moment, it seems like you've died. But then the screen flashes white, and you're fine again. In fact, many of the hallucinations involve the character's brutal death. But a particularly notable effect is when their body parts explode, piece by piece. What truly gives this feature bragging rights are its clever fourth wall breaks. You can be walking along like everything is normal, only for the screen to randomly go black, as if your TV's been turned off. Many first-timers only realize what's happened after trying to switch it back on and genuinely shutting it off. The character might suddenly begin randomly shooting around the room, making you think the game's glitched. But then, the screen will flash white, and the character will say, "This isn't really happening." Another particularly clever trick is when the game says you've completed the game and promotes its continuation in the sequel, Sanity's Redemption. Unfortunately, that sequel never actually came to be. But the idea was still brilliant for its time. You might also receive an error message warning you your controller's disconnected for no apparent reason other than the horde of zombies tearing your character apart. The bugs crawling across the television screen were equally delightful. Of course, I think the most brutal is easily when a player tries to save their game, only to be asked, "Are you sure you want to delete all of your saved games?" Obviously, no matter what answer's chosen, the response will be a deletion confirmation. The sheer panic that'll run through a player's body, particularly back then, is palpable. There are a few features that, while brilliant for their time, didn't age well. For example, when the sound cuts off, a bright green mute would appear in the top right corner, exactly as most of the older TVs showed, but not today's. The volume sliding bar down at the bottom of the blue screen of death share the same problem. The point is, this goes back to what I was telling you at the start. For real horror junkies, for those of us who really let ourselves feel it, this is what it's all about. Making it real, even for just a moment. If you can genuinely submerge yourself within the story, if you can go beyond imagining what you might do, if you can see it instead, if you can allow even a piece of your mind to believe there might be a hint of truth behind the lore, then there's nothing quite like that sublime moment of temporary disbelief when you feel like fantasy has actually crossed reality's boundary. And that is, at its core, what it's all about. Sometimes our brains simply go into survival mode. You become a third party, watching yourself as if it were all some kind of a dream. It's Darwin's autopilot and a double-edged sword in the hands of chance. Or is it destiny? You can never know, because you can never be sure. Is it real? Or have you gone crazy? Well, deep down, where do you hide your darkest fears? Would you wonder? Is true crazy incapable of recognizing itself? Or is it just too unstable to make up its mind? Is a constant state of uncertainty not, in and of itself, a little crazy? Do you believe the visions and follow their path? Is there even a choice? Maybe that's the problem, though, the all-or-nothing scenario, because it's not black and white. It's a combination. The number of options in any given situation are going to be fairly limited. No matter how well laid a plan is, you can never really control another person. They'll always prove the unknown variable. They can be influenced. enticed or discouraged, but never controlled. After all, control is such a strong word. I mean, can we even really control ourselves? These are the kind of mental gymnastics Eternal Darkness has you performing the more you dig into its content. The temple in Cambodia is actually a tomb belonging to Mantarok, the ancient represented by the color purple who was once worshipped as a fertility god. But now, Mantarok is dying. Pius is there to bind the creature so it won't be able to interfere with his master's plans, but Ilya just so happens to get in the way. She receives Mantarok's heart and, with it, his power. This ultimately allowing him to continue his influence over others, despite being bound by Pius. Unfortunately, Pius is fully aware of Mantarok's deception and, with his dark magic, he trapped Ilya in a state of undeath, leaving her sealed in the tomb as a living corpse. Chapter 3, The Darkness Calls. After following another series of clues with Alex, the next missing page begins Chapter 3, with Pius speaking to the god he serves. Pleased that Mantarok is no longer a threat, Pius is then ordered to eliminate Charlemagne the Frank, the first Holy Roman Emperor. This recalls our tension back to Edward's warning that the ancients do not want humanity to evolve. They want to keep their cattle weak and ready for slaughter. This puts us in the shoes of a young squire named Antony, who is tasked with delivering a secret message to Charlemagne. Like any normal, curious human, Antony simply can't help but read the letter for himself. But the moment it's opened, he's hit with a strong magical attack. Somehow, he's able to shake off the effects rather easily, and immediately rushes to the cathedral to warn his king of impending danger. Unfortunately, he's in such a hurry to sound the alarm, he has no idea who he can trust. Not only are the monks of the cathedral actively plotting against Charlemagne, they're actively murdering anyone who doesn't agree. Plus, he's yet to understand that Hidden Spell is slowly turning him into a zombie. His strength as well as his sanity are a constant battle to maintain. So, luckily, this is where we learn the Tome of Eternal Darkness doubles as a timeless spellbook. That's right. We were already exploring, puzzle solving, and zombie killing, and now there's a pretty intense magic system to master. Something we're not going to dive into here for the sheer volume it would take. So, instead, let's get back to poor Antony. With his new power, he's able to defeat the Archbishop and retrieve the key to Charlemagne's cell. But sadly, he arrives too late. The monks have already murdered Charlemagne, and Antony finally succumbs to the decaying curse. Thus, Chapter 3 draws to a close with another tragic ending for our hero. I warn you now, that's going to become a theme. You may also feel like we've covered a decent amount of story, but actually, we've only just finished the tutorial. These levels are simply showing us the ropes. Now, it's time to start this party for real. While it may seem as if we're traveling through random points in history, we're simply too close to realize each tiny frame is but a piece of a much grander design. And though Alex's role may feel somewhat passive, as if she were merely the method by which we discover these hidden stories, that couldn't be farther from the truth. With each new page discovered, she learns more about the ancients and their roles in not only history, but the death of her grandfather. As if that weren't enough, bit by bit, she's forced to accept she too must play a part in their plans. The ancients have no concern for humans. An individual life carries weight far less than a single ant. We're merely cattle to be fed for slaughter. For 2,000 years, forces beyond mortal comprehension have conspired to reach Earth, and for those 2,000 years, our protagonists have tried to stop them without success. Now, everything rests on Alex's shoulders. If she can't defeat Pius, he will finally finish the job and plunge the world into a state of eternal darkness. No pressure or anything, though. As Alex reads the next page, we're transported to Persia in 565 AD, where a young man, Karim, is lovesick for a woman named Chandra, who only wants to use him for his sword skills. She offers her love in exchange for a lost relic, and the man agrees without hesitation. Karim is one of the strongest fighters in the game, and a fan favorite. When he makes his way to the lost relic, Chandra's ghost apparition suddenly appears to inform Karim she's been murdered. Deceived by her own mother as others dragged her from her bed to end her life. Luckily, there's a way they can be together again. If Karim can only make one teensy-weensy little sacrifice. It's actually a very proud moment to see Karim reject her. His near-death experiences just really opened his eyes. For, you know, a fraction of a second. After a hard shutdown, Chandra goes on to complain he will become something more. Exactly as she said. And they would remain in the temple to guard the artifact against the dark forces who would come to claim it. Just when you think he's gonna go for the kill, he leans in, gives her a big ol' kiss, and has his soul sucked right out of him to be a ghost alongside his fake love for all of eternity. Another great example of real life borrowed from fabricated terror. I mean, how many of us have done something completely unexplainably idiotic in the name of love? Knowing full well how dumb you were being at the time. Yeah, exactly. This guy, like so many do, paid the ultimate price. With one kiss, he too shares the same fate as his predecessors. Pius is then free to fulfill his master's orders by returning to Persia in the Middle Ages to erect a pillar of flesh at the Forbidden City. And that is exactly what it sounds like. A giant tower made of live humans thrown into a kiln and then just kind of compressed together. Body horror at its finest. This location is eventually turned into a cathedral, and Pius summons a creature called the Black Guardian to watch over the artifact. There it's remained through 1485, when Paul Luther, a Francian monk, visited the region to view a holy relic. While there, the local Inquisition accused him of murdering a fellow monk. In an attempt to clear his name, he finds himself facing the Black Guardian, who promptly ends Paul's life. We do not return to the cathedral until it's being used as a field hospital in 1916, during World War I. Peter Jacobs, a field reporter, notices the patients are disappearing without explanation. Deciding to venture into the catacombs himself, he encounters the Black Guardian, defeats it, and recovers the artifact. Decades later, when he's old and gray, Peter passes the artifact down to Edward. When I say we're speeding through these protagonists, I am really not kidding. Chapter 4, The Forbidden City. We fast forward to 1460. As Pius is set on building this pillar of flesh, a Venetian architect by the name Roberto Bianchi is traveling through this same region when he's captured by Pius, disguised as a warlord. While enslaved, Roberto encounters Karim's spirit, and he's entrusted with his artifact. What was practically the blink of an eye to us was nearly 1,000 years for poor Karim. I imagine he was ready to be rid of it. Roberto actually attempts to warn Pius of the danger, but he's thrown into the tower himself, left to become part of its foundation with so many others. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. Eternal darkness didn't stick to the exact same pattern beginning to end. They still throw plenty of curveballs to keep you on your toes, both with the time jumps and the sheer amount of playable characters we have to get through. There's 12 total. When we meet the Canadian firefighter Michael Edwards after the Gulf War ended in 91, he's in the middle of extinguishing oil fires in the Middle East. In the previous chapters, we found the Tome of Eternal Darkness rather quickly and proceeded through the level with an arsenal of spells at our disposal. This is where things shift slightly. The developers didn't want players to simply blow through the levels with magic. So Michael doesn't find the tome until almost the end of his level. You must face most of his adventure without the assistance of spells. Taking away a core mechanic you felt comfortable with for safety in another manner altogether, in which this game proceeds to test your limits. When an explosion kills his entire team, Michael's left trapped in this forbidden city, where he meets Roberto's spirit and receives the artifact, with instructions to deliver it to the Roivas family estate. Michael destroys the city with a magically charged bomb before departing, and a few months later, the artifact is safely delivered into Edward's hands. Likewise, many of the characters have similar twists to keep the player guessing, but they all culminate in Edward receiving each artifact. In Chapter 10, we finally solve our murder mystery by playing as Edward himself, our narrator from the very beginning. The Roivas mansion was built over the ancient city of Inga, so his line could protect the portal separating our world from that of the undead. As each of his ancestors before, Edward also eventually finds himself in the Lost City, attempting to stop the ancients' plans. In the center, he discovers a huge 9-point power circle where, with the proper rune placement, he should be able to destroy the entire labyrinth. Once this is done, the power of the god who rivals the one Pius chose is channeled through the Stargate's machinery, which unleashes a magical force and destroys the twisted citizens of the Nameless City. Under the belief that these otherworldly beings were finally destroyed, Edward settled down to spend the next 48 years of his life learning all he could of these ancient beings who played such a part in his family history. But sadly, he too met an unfortunate end when the ancients' power once again reached into our world and destroyed the only man who knew of their existence. Of course, this brings us to where our journey began, with Alex learning of her grandfather's demise and beginning her search through the manor. Now, with her journey coming to a close, she too discovers the ancient lost city hidden beneath her family home. And she must face the same nightmare as those before her. Except with this one, it's quite literally for all the marbles. When she too finds herself at the 9-point power circle, she does things a little differently. She incorporates the 3 relics with the summoning spell so the Stargate could essentially hijack the juice from Pius's hard work. This results in summoning the starter ancient's rival. Then, it's all down to the battle of your life. But once you've won this battle, you will successfully have defeated Eternal Darkness. For the first of 4 possible playthroughs, that is. Eternal Darkness has a hidden, true ending. To see it, you need to beat the game 3 times. 1 with each of the 3 relics selected during Pius's opening level. After each playthrough, your save file will be marked with the rune of the ancient you killed, meaning it's probably a really good idea to see what happens if you collect them all. On the final time around, an extra cutscene reveals the truth behind the game after Edward Roivas' disappearance. Big spoilers ahead, by the way. Mantarok, the dying god from the Cambodian temple, was orchestrating quite a lot from deep within its tomb. As it would turn out, he was dominant against all 3 of the other ancients, which explains why Pius was so desperate to keep it imprisoned. Instead of health, sanity, or magic, Mantarok controls time, a plot device we've seen throughout the game. I mean, essentially, Eternal Darkness is 3 different stories taking place at once, only in different timelines. When Alex summons the monster over the Nameless City, there are actually 3 Alexes summoning each ancient, only from alternate timelines. Mantarok had always been there, influencing others where needed to ensure all 3 of its enemies were defeated. Some have argued the game isn't worth 3 playthroughs with minimal changes just for an extra cutscene, but it could also be argued that it depends entirely upon the player's love for the game. How many times have we played our own favorites with absolutely no changes, doing the same routine over and over and over? Well, that's part of the reason speedruns become so popular. Sheer desperation for any excuse to keep playing the classics. Of course, if Mantarok were truly the last ancient, what would they have been saving for the sequel? There was confirmation of a planned 5th ancient designated by the color yellow as shown in the unaligned runes, disintegrating enemies, the magic afflicting Antony, and certain floor traps. Supposedly, this final ancient would negate the powers of the other 4, but no greater storyline was ever confirmed other than the fact that it was based on the Great Old Ones from Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, likely Haster, who in turn was inspired by The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers. Either way, it's worth viewing the full story as it was meant to be enjoyed. But remember, this was never meant to be the end. The developers always intended to create a series, but sadly, fate wasn't on their side. Not only did the game sell poorly for the reasons we discussed earlier, other factors played a part in its cancellation. There was talk of a sequel, a trademark being renewed to spark fan excitement, but legal troubles would ultimately cause things to stall for good and actually leave the game to remain a standalone in people's minds. But one could argue, and it would appear, that the game was destined to remain a powerful entry in the horror genre for those who experienced it personally, as well as a potential new passion for new fans stumbling across a video on it on YouTube. It brings a sad and muted end to the short life of Eternal Darkness. An extremely ambitious game with mature themes sold on a console that was largely shying away from those concepts, not fully appreciated or understood by its core audience, until almost a decade later, and then sold on a console that was doomed to play second fiddle to Sony's huge titan, the PlayStation 2, the best-selling console of all time. For them, the game was rigged from the start. But passionate followers never stopped defending the game and recommending it to others, especially as the rise of complex psychological horror has reached the mainstream. In turn, the horror industry has embraced mature storytelling and overt themes in lieu of, admittedly still very fun, outright gore fests with no plot. There's an understanding among aficionados, now that you can enjoy the grotesque imagery of Mad God with an allegorical plot largely hanging high in the sky, and the slow, creeping horror of something like The Lighthouse. The same can be said for gaming. Those same fans that gravitate toward the unmitigated violence of Manhunt, Callisto Protocol, and The Suffering can equally be disturbed, if not more so, by the psychological styling of Amnesia, The Dark Descent, Darkwood, Soma, and Detention, just to name a few. And they can all trace at least some of their inspiration back to that ambitious title in 2002, Eternal Darkness. There's still more game to cover, more to dissect, and more to share with you all. But for now, pick up a game you love and settle in for something comforting, something frightening, or something containing a little bit of both. We'll be back with more unsettling stories under the surface. I'm Autumn Ivy, and this is The Dark Side of Gaming. Until next time, friends, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.